The Senate took a big step towards passing a major school funding bill by overriding Governor Rauner's veto. The House will vote this Wednesday. When can public schools across the state expect to get the money they're owed? Plus, officials from the Round Lake School District say they're overwhelmed by the support they've gotten from the community after last month's floods. It's come in the form of books.
I would say when all is said and done, over 100,000 books have come to us. Something that was catastrophic has turned into just such a positive thing.
And there's only one more week until the total solar eclipse.
The last time we had a coast-to-coast total solar eclipse that was visible in the U.S., it was 1918. If enough people hop in their car to go down, we could see some really terrifically huge traffic jams.
We'll tell you what you need to know to get ready for this once-in-a-lifetime chance. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. The latest news is next. I'm Nyla Boodoo. It's been a busy weekend of news, starting here in Illinois with lots of news at 5 o'clock that started on Friday with Governor Rauner. Lots of action on bills. Of course, we need to talk about the Illinois politicians reacting to horrific events in Charlottesville this weekend. And yesterday, the state Senate overriding Governor Rauner's veto of school funding. It's Monday. It's when we talk politics. We try to catch you up over everything that happened over the weekend. There's a lot that we have to go through. Joining me on the line now from Chicago is Natasha Karecki. She writes the Illinois Playbook for Politico. And from Springfield, Ray Hodge is a Springfield editor for the Daily Line. Natasha, Ray, welcome back to the 21st. Thank you, both of you, for being with me this morning.
Thank you. And thank you.
Natasha, let's start with Saturday's events in Charlottesville, the white supremacist neo-Nazi rally that turned violent, one of the counter-protesters, Heather Heyer, killed. I wanted to just start by how Illinois politicians have reacted to this. I'm thinking of just even our congressional delegation, Republican Representative Rodney Davis, had a whole series of tweets yesterday about being in Normandy last month. He said neo-Nazis in Charlottesville are not only racist and wrong, they are offensive to those who sacrificed to never see that flag again. And then he shared the whole series of pictures, about 5 to 10 pictures of grave sites of Illinois soldiers who had died, he said, saving the world from Nazism. It was pretty much on par with what we saw across our delegation, whether they're Republican or Democrat, Natasha?
I think for Republicans, especially for Rodney Davis, who's a target, he's not only showing that this is, his view of this incident in isolation, but he's also separating himself from Donald Trump, who has gotten all kinds of grief for not specifically, calling out, the Nazi group, what many believe it is. And for not calling it terrorism himself. Yes, we've seen a lot of that from the delegation and also from local lawmakers. And we saw the Illinois Senate yesterday, approve a resolution. It's just a resolution, but it did get a lot of attention because, what they did was say, hey, we want to urge law enforcement officials to recognize white nationalists and white neo-Nazi groups as terrorist organizations. And, it sends a powerful message at, a very sensitive time.
Ray, can you tell us a little bit more about what the lawmakers passed yesterday, or at least in the Senate? Ray, it sounds like we're having a hard... Ray, can you hear us?
Yes, thank you. Still with you. How am I going through?
There you go.
Wonderful. So what we saw in the Senate yesterday was obviously a nice bipartisan move that really echoed a lot of the outrage that we're seeing online and across the board. Republican members joined with Democratic members to push for a clear definition and a clear articulation against the actions that we saw in Charlottesville. Now, we also did see, although it wasn't as quite a large and dramatic move, Governor Rauner did, of course, tweet out on the 12th that his thoughts and prayers were with those in Charlottesville at the time. But what we saw on the Senate floor yesterday was a very strong move from Senator Daniel Biss as well. And Biss's family, his great-grandparents, were actually, unfortunately, murdered in Auschwitz 73 years ago. And it was really spectacular, I'll tell you, to be there in the gallery in a normally very noisy, busy chamber, and watch everybody come to a halt. You could really hear a pin drop in the room as Senator Biss sort of explained his family's history and the significance of this very touchy moment for everyone in the chamber. And then you saw a great deal of bipartisan concurrence, of course.
Mm-hmm. And then, of course, there are the politics of this. As you mentioned, Ray, Governor Rauner did tweet pretty early on Saturday it's around 2:30 on Saturday, saying, "My thoughts are with Charlottesville and Virginia. There's no excuse for violence and bigotry. We must stand together against hate." Natasha, I noticed Alderman Pawar, who's running for governor, tweeted at him saying, "It's white supremacy and terrorism. Why aren't you seeing that?" I wonder, did we see very much of that also from other people? I wonder how much of this is also other candidates for governor sort of seizing on this as a political moment, unfortunately. Natasha, I wonder your thoughts on that.
Right. Well, even apparently this morning, Governor Rauner had an appearance in Chicago, and Juliana Stratton, who is now the running mate for Pritzker, tweeted out that Governor Rauner called the event callous and horrible this morning, but he wouldn't call it terrorism. And so she is seizing on that already. I'm seeing a lot of these retweets and this feed kind of light up. She says just finished signing, a bill that she, helped co-sponsor. Rauner signed it, but refused, and she puts in all caps, to call the acts in Charlottesville an act of terrorism. So it does seem like they're seizing on this distinction right now and politically just kind of hitting people with it.
Mm-hmm. Governor Rauner also had an interview with Fox News on Friday. We're going to get to that in a moment. I want to go back to what happened on the Senate floor yesterday. Ray, the past few weeks have all been about school funding, SB1. State money will not be given to K-12 schools unless Illinois introduces what's called this evidence-based funding formula. The State House passed the bill, just to catch everybody up. Governor Rauner issued an amendatory veto. Ray, tell us what happened in the Senate yesterday.
So a lot of talk has come out of the key group of negotiators, which were brought to the table, hoping to hash out an agreement about the proposed amendatory vetoes, which Rauner issued, and the contents of SB1, with a couple of the key turning points being the Chicago Public Schools pension system and the block grant, which is normally issued to them. We did see a full override of the governor's veto yesterday. And while some of it went along party lines, what we also saw, interestingly, was Senator Sam McCann, who did change his vote. He went ahead and voted with the override. One of the interesting things about that, of course, is that McCann, as it was noted yesterday by Rich Miller of Capital Facts, he did receive a $53,000 campaign contribution last month from the Illinois Educators Association. So continuing that momentum on in terms of getting SB1 through the House, where it is now going and where the House will convene on Wednesday, may be a matter of checking out which key Republicans might be open to negotiation.
Natasha, on Friday, Senator Andy Menar was on the 21st, and he said that he hoped that there would be a path to compromise, but if there wasn't, Democrats would find a way to solve this problem one way or another. What do yesterday's actions say about whether compromise really is possible at this point, or is it even necessary in terms of the numbers?
Certainly if the House may still have some difficulty finding enough Republican votes to come over to do a full override. So I think that's why there are negotiations continuing. Is Rauner going to get what he wants? He has very little leverage right now, given just pure numbers and just, all the controversies that have been surrounding him with, his staff and just the rollout of this SB1 and some of the funding numbers that were hung up and didn't come until really, really late.
Were the numbers released yesterday finally?
Yeah, I think it was Saturday.
Okay.
Saturday the numbers finally came through, and it showed what a lot of people had expected, which was that Chicago was going to get nailed. And basically, the extra money that they were going to get, he redistributed throughout the state. I think negotiations will continue for the very reason of trying to get some more Republicans on board, and if they can't do that,
that Democrats will, as a lot of people were saying, that the House has 15 days to take up the measure from the first time, I believe, from the first reading of it in the House. So they, even though they're going to take up this vote on Wednesday, they don't have to take up the vote on Wednesday. They can take up the issue. They can do lots of different things to apply more pressure, take more time, drag it out a bit, and get more Republicans feeling like they're in a desperate situation and voting their way. I mean, I'm not saying that that's the way to go. I'm just saying, given Mike Madigan's tactics in the past, I wouldn't be surprised if that's what happened.
Natasha, can I just ask you about the information, the funding numbers that finally came out on Saturday? You said Chicago gets hit the most. I want to ask you about downstate, everyone else outside, or not just downstate, but other districts outside of Chicago, because that had been one of the things that Governor Rauner had said, that they, other districts outside of Chicago would not be affected. Did the numbers show that they wouldn't be affected, or that was more that Chicago was most affected?
Well, I mean, Ray probably can talk about that.
Yeah, Ray, if you want to hop in here also, either of you.
Sure, absolutely. One of the things that we're seeing, just to piggyback off of what Tasha is saying, because she's absolutely right here, absolutely, the House has the ability to play for time. And one of the things that we saw yesterday, which I know, Natasha, you were probably as avid as you are to watch these sort of maneuvers, I'm sure you saw it as well. The House Bill 3163 got passed out of Senate yesterday. And what that does is exactly as Natasha is saying, that allows Democrats to play for more time. It's more or less the understudy of SB 1. So if SB 1, having left the Senate now, goes to the House, if it should fail an override under Madigan's watch, the Senate has already passed 3163. It contains an amendment, which is all of the SB 1 language in total. And all they have to do at that point is send that new House bill over to Rauner's desk. That would allow them to start the veto and override process all over again.
Two bills? Is that what you're saying?
Yes, ma'am. That's absolutely correct. What happened yesterday was SB 1 did get over the mandatory veto did get overridden, right? So it comes out of the Senate and now goes to the House. If SB 1 fails to be overridden in the House, something the Senate did yesterday provides a great deal of interest for Democrats who would like to play for longer time. They approved a measure called House Bill 3163. Now, this is more or less a shell bill, which I'm sure many of your listeners are more than acquainted with, a bill which is taken off the shelf and put new language into it in order to continue it along its path. What happened is that this shell bill was loaded with an amendment, and that amendment has identical language to Senate Bill 1. It has already been passed out of the House, and yesterday its approval from the Senate means that it has cleared both houses. This means that should the House fail to override SB 1, this new shell bill, which contains all of its same provisions, will be sent to the governor's desk. The governor then would have the same options to act upon it as he did with SB 1, which is highly likely he would, given his actions towards SB 1 and the contents of it.
So it sounds like we're back into a little bit of the same loop here. Let me ask you just one other big story from this weekend. Natasha, I'm going to ask you to weigh in on the rest of this interview, because I know you were very active paying attention to this. Governor Rauner didn't get the response he hoped for when he gave a national interview to Fox News on Friday afternoon with Brett Baier. Let's play just a little bit of clip of that.
Our immigration system is broken, and we need to have a system that keeps the people of Illinois safe, the people of America safe. We got to put that as the first priority.
So I'm still trying to get, do you agree with the president or not that sanctuary cities are a problem?
Well, I tell you this. What I say is immigration in America is broken. We make illegal immigration easy, and we make legal immigration almost impossible. We need dramatic immigration reform.
Natasha, I'm not sure if you counted how many times he said the system is broken. That was sort of his answer. You could hear a little bit of the exasperation in Brett Baier's voice there, because I think at that point during the interview, it was about an 8-minute interview, he said, OK, let's move on and talk about the budget since you're not going to really answer this question. I guess the key here is why this became such a national story as well is well-known conservative Ann Coulter. I'm not going to repeat what she said, but she called Governor Rauner a slur that's used for people with mental disabilities. She was tweeting during the interview. That kind of got a lot more attention from people. Natasha, can you kind of sum up how the rest of the interview went and what kind of reaction we saw over the weekend with this?
Well, you know, one of the reasons it was so trumped up is because, you know, Browner doesn't give national interviews often. So here you have Brett Baer coming in. You know, Brett Baer was advertising this on social media and elsewhere that, hey, I got the first national interview with the governor. Well, he's a national reporter, so of course he's going to ask about Sanctuary City. You know, Illinois is in the middle of that with Chicago and Rahm Emanuel filing a lawsuit. And health care, these two basic gigantic issues. Well, guess what? Browner has not weighed in on these topics. Browner, as we know, has not even mentioned Donald Trump's name. I was personally very intrigued to see how Browner was going to handle this interview, and it kind of went a lot of these interviews go with local reporters, which is to say he deflects, he doesn't answer the question, you know, where do you fall on health care? He doesn't give, you know, we didn't even know where the governor fell on health care until after the Congress passed it. Then he put out a statement saying he was going to work on it. So, you know, it was a lot of dodging. And the thing is, he was on the national stage. So it wasn't just, you know, our little, Twitter Illinois weighing in on this. This was national people saying, what the heck? Who is this governor from Illinois who will not weigh in on answer a simple immigration question in sanctuary cities, yes or no? Simple health care question. You know, we've had governors from other states, Republican governors from other blue states who have, you know, sent letters urging Congress against, you know, this Trump care and so forth. Browner has stayed away from that because of the politics of Illinois. And I think this really just put a spotlight on that. And Browner's refusal to answer some, you know, what I think are very basic questions.
Yeah, unfortunately, we're out of time. That's Natasha Korecki with the Illinois Playbook for Politico. I want to thank her as well as Ray Hodge. She edits the Daily Line from Springfield. Ladies, thanks so much for being with me. I appreciate it.
Hey, thank you so very much. I do appreciate it.
The 21st is made possible by Kester & Bradley, LLP, providing legal services to the Urbana-Champaign community and Illinois residents since 1895. Kester & Bradley's attorneys are committed to achieving the best results for their clients. More information is available at KesterLawLLP.com.
To the 21st, I'm Nyla Boodoo. 4 feet of water stood at W.J. Murphy Elementary School in Round Lake Park after the historic flooding last month in northern Illinois. The floods destroyed two libraries in the Round Lake Area School District 116. We heard immediately from W.J. Elementary after the flooding. Since then, they and the district launched a campaign to bring donated books to restock libraries. We wanted to check back in to see what the response has been. Lori Plasek is the executive assistant to the superintendent of Round Lake School District 116. She's on the line with us now to talk about how the book donation process has been going. Lori, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Nyla. Happy to be here.
So I mentioned 4 feet of water in this one school in particular. Can you remind us of the damage you had into two libraries in particular in your district?
Right. I think Murphy got a lot of attention right away just because of social media. Some posts happened, you know, within hours of that, and they were pictures of Murphy. So I think the narrative was for the community initially that it was Murphy that had damage. But while Murphy sustained nearly $2 million in damage, Ellis sustained nearly $1 million. So, you know, those are really significant numbers for both buildings. Our cleanup is going phenomenally well. We anticipate that the school year will start on time for all of our buildings. So we're excited about that.
And what's been your response to the campaign for books?
Well, it's been amazing, and really the response was not initiated with us. We had gotten a few phone calls from parents, teachers, the director of our public library said, hey, should we do a book drive? Because in those initial hours, we weren't quite sure what this was and what this was going to be. I knew, having worked in libraries in the past, what a beast this could turn into. People have real emotional ties to books. I knew we could potentially have either 3 boxes of books or 3,000. I would say we are leaning closer to 3,000
Wow.
Books. So it has been an amazing outpouring. And most of this was generated through social media. Like I said, Jim Dionata, the director of our public library, had posted it on his Facebook, the library Facebook page, and it kind of, I think, took off from there. It went to other libraries. It circulated through public. We have had support from public school districts in the area. Libertyville has been great. McHenry has donated some library furniture. You know, something that was catastrophic has turned into just such a positive thing. To put it in a little perspective, Bernie's Book Bank was one of the first calls I made, because I called them and I said, hey, you know, I don't know how many books we're going to get. Would you be willing to pick up what we don't deem, you know, appropriate for a school library, for classroom libraries? They said, yeah, great, no problem. We found out within about a day and a half that it looked like our insurance was going to, you know, cover what was damaged. So that was our message from the get-go. We told people calling and contacting us that, you know, lucky for us, that would be covered. The people most affected by this were our community, our families. They lost, you know, so much in this flood. So we really kind of came up with a full circle thing that just kind of manifested on its own. The public library is kind of focused. I would say they have received probably 10,000 books. They're going to focus on getting those books directly back to the families in the community. Bernie's Book Bank has taken 30,000 books to date, and those are just what we deemed, you know, again, not appropriate for a classroom, a school library. They will probably be picking up 10,000 more early next week. I would say when all is said and done, over 100,000 books have come to us.
Where are you putting all of them, and who's sorting through all of this?
We have a team that has been working diligently for the last week and a half. We're here now. Our space we're working out of a great room space, was almost empty this morning. It is almost full again today at the end of the day. The books just keep coming. So we're working hard. We have them in storage here. So we're kind of staging it. We're kind of just dealing with it as it comes to us. But again, Bernie's has been great. They, you know, I give them a call and they are here within a day or two to pick up the books and get them to their space. They've indicated to us that the books they have received from us will be able to service over 2,500 kids in this area, which I think is amazing in itself. So that is great.
So that's fantastic. I'm sure you all are very grateful for the books. Is the message now that maybe people probably don't need to send any more books, or what are you telling
folks? I think we can say we do have organizations and that have been doing book drives. So those, when they call and say, "Hey, we're done. We've got the books ready to go," we of course welcome those. We're ready for those. You know, we're sorting. We're working through our system. You know, getting Bernie's to pick up what we weed through and aren't going to use. Then we've got ours that we're moving to storage. But yes, I think we could say, you know, we could wind down if folks want to. Also, we've received, you know, our Ed Foundation has stepped up and said that they would accept monetary donations, which has been great, because an aspect of this is that we'll be able to, the libraries that were completely damaged, we get to rethink that. We get to move them to more 21st century learning environment. We're looking at that. So all the money that is received from our Ed Foundation is going to go to the restoration of the library spaces for the kids in Round Lake.
Well, we're glad to hear that not only has the response been overwhelming and you guys are getting support, but that you're able to clean up and that school will be opening on time for folks. I know that's really important. So thank you so much for giving us an update. That's Lori Plasek. She's executive assistant to the superintendent, Round Lake School District 116. Very busy in these coming weeks before school starts. So we appreciate you taking the time. Thanks so much, Lori.
Thank you.
You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo, and that's music from the independent Cuban video game Savior, which is featured at the newly opened Video Game Art Gallery. The gallery is one of a few of its kind in North America. It's had its grand opening at the Bloomingdale Arts Building in Chicago last Friday. It displays artwork from independent games all over the world, including the game Savior. Jonathan Kinkley is co-founder and executive director of the VGA Gallery. Chaz Evans is co-founder and director of exhibitions and programs, and they're with me now. Jonathan, Chaz, welcome to the 21st.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Delighted to be here. Thank you.
Jonathan, let's talk about the gallery. Why was it important to you that there's a physical space to showcase video game art and artists?
As a medium, video games are evolving as an art form, and it was important for us to put video games in a context that you would normally experience fine art, for example. And many games are fine art and deserving of that platform, and we wanted to create a space for inquiry, discussion, community, and that is best resolved through a gallery model.
Chaz, you guys had your grand opening last Friday. How long has this been in the making?
It's been in the making for some time. We did our first public exhibition in 2014, and of course we were working on the project before that even. So at least three plus years in the making has led to the grand opening this Friday.
And I mentioned part of the challenge of this is people maybe don't think of video games as having art within them. I mean, we played some music. Maybe people don't even think of the music that's in video games, right?
Right.
You don't think of that on its own either.
Yeah. Well, in fact, video games both contain art and artworks. The word art can apply in different ways. But, of course, there's artists using skills from illustration and animation, making the assets inside the game. But then there are all these creative decisions that are made even by the programmers and the technicians. And also those have sort of conceptual weight behind them as well. So both the behind-the-scenes stuff and the finished product can be considered as sort of in a fine art perspective.
Jonathan, what do you say to people who are skeptical? I wonder, do you share your experiences of where you've seen, do you point to specific pieces in the gallery that you feel like you want people to see? And then when they see that, they'll think, okay, I get it. This is where I'm seeing the art in a video game.
There is usually a disconnect. Most people aren't used to talking about video games and art in the same sentence, and that is something we're trying to change. At a scholarly and critical level, that battle has been kind of waged for years, and we view it as having been won. Video games have been collected by major museums, written about in the highest scholarly journals, and appreciated as art forms. And so what we try to do with games is to further that discussion and also promote inquiry and critique of games as a medium.
So when you guys say that, let's use the example of Savior. Mm-hmm. Can you tell me a little bit? Who wants to tell me a little bit about that game? So that's a indie video game that was developed in Cuba.
That's right. So there are video games, have been video games coming out of Cuba for some time. They're usually coming out of universities or sort of institutions that have certain standards or topics that are covered. And so what's unique about Savior and the two artists who've made it, Josue Pagliari and Johan Armenteros, they aren't a part of any affiliation in Havana or any sort of places getting state funding. They have entirely crowdfunded the game on their own, and therefore they can make a game about whatever they want to make it about. They've made this game that's kind of it's very metaphysical. It is kind of about the world falling apart around you, and that is pretty counterintuitive for what you normally expect when you're playing a game. In the game, there is combat, and it looks and feels like some conventional video games that way, but instead of leveling up or gaining new abilities, the world starts to fall apart the more you sort of gain victories.
Oh, that's interesting. Oh, wow. So how did you guys decide what ended up in the gallery?
That is always a conversation between the artists and we as curators, and it's different every time. There's absolutely no blanket way to curate video games in a gallery setting, and it's always finding the right space and resolving the right pieces. So sometimes that involves taking moments of the game and resolving them as 2D prints that are hung on the wall. Sometimes it's about making sure there's multiple stations where people can get their hands on controllers and play with the game, and also positioning those two categories of pieces alongside each other so that both kind of reinforce and extend each other. And then there can be other ideas, because every time we see a new game, there's another idea for how to show it.
For you guys, I wonder personally if there are games that for you, was there a game that you played that created this idea in your head that this is an art form that people need to experience it that way? Jonathan, you're nodding your head.
Yes, I would cite two games. First, growing up, the King's Quest IV game as part of a publication by Sierra, an Oakland-based company, really opened my eyes to games as a medium. It was immersive. It was theatrical. It had great music. It had great visuals. It was the synthesis of all media and this incredible narrative that completely sucked you in. And I was blown away by the impact it had on my life. But also, in more recent years, a game that came out and helped fuel the conversation that Chaz and I were having about creating a space for games was Sword and Sorcery by Super Brothers, a Toronto-based group that published a great game created for the iPad. So it was a new platform, a new interface, a new media. And it was a game that was self-aware like any others. It was simultaneously nostalgic by incorporating kind of a pixelated aesthetic as a hallmark to earlier generations of gaming, but it also incorporated incredible use of music by Jim Guthrie, written language by Super Brothers, and a very unique and inventive gameplay mechanic.
Yeah, it's hard to, of course, choose one. The first time I started writing about video games through an art historical perspective, I was dealing with this game called We Heart Katamari, which is the sequel to Katamari Damacy. But anyway, it's a pretty absurdist game from Japan where you roll up the entire universe in a ball. It's the quickest way I could describe it. And so I wrote about that in terms of it being a Brechtian video game. And I thought, okay, this is all making sense now. But then as far as the work we see, we're inspired by all these artists that we're working with. One that really opened up my eyes to how video games can work as a contemporary art piece would be the cardboard computer series Kentucky Route Zero, which it's probably not enough time to explain the entire project. It is large, but I sort of describe it as if Jim Jarmusch tried to make a video game.
Okay. And then there's the whole business side of this as well, right? And I just want to ask you one last question about that. You guys raised about $10,000 or so on Kickstarter. You have a really also interesting idea that this space can also be rented as an Airbnb. How do you think that will work? Do you think that will help sustain it a little bit?
As a not-for-profit, Jazz and I have been working in museums and galleries for more than a decade now, and so we're very well-versed in how these types of organizations work. Diversified revenue streams are very important, and we try to work with all the fundamentals that major institutions work with. That includes grants. That includes individual donations. We sell limited edition posters and prints to raise earned revenue. We have fabulous benefit parties. Our upcoming hardcore casual benefit on September 9th is sold out, and that will be a fun night celebrating VGA. Corporate sponsorships, board of director giving,
And the Airbnb.
And the Airbnb to further subsidize rent for the space.
Okay, so this is the video game art gallery in Chicago, kind of between Humboldt Park, Logan Square, Wicker Park. Jonathan Kinkley is co-founder and executive director of the VGA Gallery. Chaz Evans is co-founder and a director of exhibitions and programs. As I said, it's open now, so if you're in Chicago, you can come see it. Thanks so much, guys.
Thank you.
As a reminder, we love hearing feedback from you. You can always get in touch with us. Leave us a voicemail, send us an email. All of that information is at our website, 21stshow.org. That's where you can leave us a voicemail, send us an email, give us feedback. We'd love to hear from you. If you follow us on Facebook, search for the 21st to like us. You can also post questions or comments you'd like us to ask on air. And if you follow our Twitter handle, our Twitter handle is 21stshow, that's 21st show. During the program, we live tweet with more background and context analysis on what we're talking about. And when we're not on air, you can follow us for the latest in Illinois news. Our handle is 21st Show. Stay tuned. The 21st continues after this short break.
Support for the 21st comes from the School of Social Work at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, preparing tomorrow's leaders to be advocates for and agents of social change. More information at socialwork.illinois.edu.
First, thanks for tuning in. Next Monday, the moon's shadow will cover the sun. For millions of people, it's a once-in-a-lifetime chance to see what's being called the Great American Eclipse. The solar eclipse will cut from west to east across the entire continental U.S. But if you want to see the real deal, there's only about a 60-mile space where people can see the total solar eclipse in its full glory. If you haven't heard by now, one of those places is southern Illinois. Towns there are gearing up for a huge influx of visitors from all over the world. NASA told the town of Carbondale, population around 26,000, to expect at least double that, around 50,000 people, to come to town for the event. They're one of many towns getting ready for the big day. I'm joined on the line now by Janika Lopez, an Eclipse Assistant Coordinator for Carbondale Tourism. Also joining us is Diane Kelly. She's a freelance science writer who wrote a great article for 538 called 2 Minutes of Darkness with 20,000 Strangers. Both of you, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Thank you.
You're very welcome.
Diane, let's start with you. People can see the eclipse in some form from almost anywhere in the continental U.S. No matter where you are, I know the moon shadow will cover a portion of the sun next Monday. Can you tell us what's so special about this? Why you think people are planning to make the trip into this path to see the moon cover the sun?
First of all, yes, you're right. Everywhere in the country is going to have at least a partial eclipse. But the difference between a partial eclipse and a total eclipse is pretty stark. And that's really just because the sun is very, very bright. So when the moon covers like 80% or 90% of the sun, you still aren't going to see that much of a difference as far as dimming of light in the overall environment. It's only on the when you're on the path of totality, which is that 60 to 70 mile wide strip of the country that's going to span between around Salem, Oregon to Charleston, South Carolina, that you get where the sun will be completely covered by the moon's disk. And then, you know, it will go dark at night. It will go dark in the middle of the day. And, apparently you'll see the stars come out. And, you know, personally, I've never seen a total eclipse myself, and I'm really excited about having this chance, because this is the first time in my life that I'm going to have a chance to go see one.
Right. And for Diane, for a lot of people, right, and I know when I saw this in your story, one expert estimates that there's like 75 million people in the U.S. within a 200-mile drive of this path. What are people predicting are going to happen to all the towns who are along this path, Diane?
Well, a lot of the towns, particularly the small towns, are preparing for the biggest tourist, the biggest influx of tourists that they've ever seen. So I talked to some very small towns that, you know, have maybe 200 to a few thousand people, and most of them are expecting the number of visitors between about, you know, 25,000 or, you know, 25,000, 50,000 people showing up on their doorstep. And that's pretty significant when you're a town of 200.
Right. And so, Janika, for your for Carbondale, obviously Carbondale is a little bit bigger than that. But what are you guys thinking in terms of crowds? To basically double the size of the town at least?
That 61,000 visitors will be descending upon Carbondale, Illinois. Our usual population is around 26,000, and the university typically brings in 17,000. So to have an additional 61,000 individuals just coming for the total solar eclipse is incredible.
Janika, when did Carbondale start planning for this?
The Carbondale Tourism Office started planning about 2 years ago. The city of Carbondale joined forces with us about a year ago to really hone in and knock out the logistics and fine details that needed to be finalized for the next few weeks.
Right. And so can you give us a sense of what some of those logistics are? Because there's fun things, but there's also practical things, right? Like making sure there's enough bathrooms and that people have enough to eat and drink.
Yes.
How have you guys handled that?
We have a committee of about 20 individuals. There's a representative from the police force, the fire department, City of Carbondale, Tourism, SIU, basically every department that you can think of that has a hand in something in Carbondale is represented on this committee. So we have an individual that's dedicated to handling the porta potties and hand washing stations. We have an individual who's dedicated to handling the parking passes. For this weekend, we're having an open alcohol ordinance. So there's an individual handling the wristbands to distribute to all the liquor license holders. There are tons of events planning. So in Carbondale, we have a main street, we have a tourism office, and we have a city. So each individual planned their own event. Carbondale Tourism has planned an Eclipse Marketplace that will have live music and vendors to mitigate some of these crowds. Main Street will have a separate event in the evening, concerts such as tribute bands and 80s night and the homegrown stage to mitigate the night crowds. And then there's a dedicated area for family fun that will contain face painting and balloon making and just any activities and games for children with children entertainers. So with these separate entities, we're able to mitigate some of those crowds and confine them into certain areas and not have them wandering off into our residential areas. We also plan to have remote parking lot areas because inside of town there aren't a lot of large areas where people can truly park. So the city owns lots beyond the city that people can park at, and then we're shuttling those individuals into the downtown area so all the traffic isn't gridlocking our downtown area.
Diane, does this sound similar to what you've heard from other towns along the path of the eclipse, things that were the types of things that Carbondale's planning?
Yeah, it does. A lot of towns are thinking pretty strongly, you know, pretty seriously about traffic issues, certainly about food issues, and porta potties seem to be on everybody's minds. A lot of towns are also thinking about what's going to happen if there's an emergency, since, suddenly doubling or tripling or more the size of your town can really put pressure on what you normally have as, you know, emergency management. So, you know, your hospitals, your doctors. And everyone's concerned about eye protection, of course. And a lot of towns are also making sure that they have those solar eclipse glasses, the special solar filters. Some towns are giving them out. Some towns are selling them to try to recoup some of the costs, because obviously this much tourism planning is going to incur some pretty significant costs on especially very small towns.
Mm-hmm. Janika, what are you guys doing about glasses? I mean, obviously, it's a good warning for everyone who's listening, if they haven't heard it enough already, that it's obviously not safe, particularly for most people in Illinois. For most of the people who are listening, they're not going to be in an area where it's safe for them to look at the eclipse. What are you guys doing? Are you going to be passing out glasses to people? Are you selling them? Or how are you making that available?
We are selling glasses. We served as a distribution hub. So we created a large order in between a lot of our businesses in town. We placed an order for 74,000 pairs of glasses.
Wow.
And each business is selling to recoup for costs, certainly. The university will be distributing glasses to individuals who purchase tickets to the Saluki Stadium for free. And there will be some other destinations on Southern Illinois University campus that will be distributing glasses for free. They received a large donation from NASA as well as Google to be able to have extra glasses in our area.
And Diane, can you let people know why the glasses are important?
Well, the glasses are important because the sun is really bright. If you were to go outside today and look up at the sun, you would flinch away, right? Because the sun, if you look directly at the sun, it's so bright that it would damage your eyes. The same problem happens during the eclipse. I mean, in most places where there's a partial eclipse, the sun is so bright that you won't be able to see the moon progress across the sun's disk unless you have those glasses in the first place. But when if you are on the path of totality, one thing that happens, I should stress that it, during totality, when the moon is completely covering the sun's disk, it is safe to take the glasses off and look at the eclipse. But the few minutes right before totality and right after totality when the sun is almost covered, so it's starting to dim, or it's still a little dim, but a rim of the sun is still visible. That rim of the sun, even though it's not bright enough to trigger your reflex to flinch away, it's still bright enough to damage your eyes.
Diane, you also made the point in your 538 piece that people who might decide to see the eclipse last minute need to make sure that they're self-sufficient on their drive. What other kinds of things should they do?
Well, I should stress first that everyone who wants to see the eclipse, I think, should really go try to see the eclipse. They just shouldn't go blindly. So they plan ahead, you know, be prepared. Be prepared for a lot of traffic. The last time we had a coast-to-coast total solar eclipse that was visible in the U.S., it was 1918. So the last time this happened, we had cars, but our roads were terrible. So there certainly were no interstates. So the car tourism was not a big thing at the time. So the ease of travel is attractive for making people want to get, you know, hop in the car and go down. But if enough people hop in their car to go down, we could see some really terrifically huge traffic jams. So try to be, you know, try to plan ahead about where you might want to go see the eclipse. Try to get there ahead of time. Ahead of time, like the day before, if you can. Don't assume that anywhere local will have enough food. So a lot of places are prepared and have food, but you can't, you know, some of the really little towns may be overwhelmed and may not have enough groceries or supplies to handle the number of people they could get. So, you know, pack up food for yourself, pack up water for yourself. Make sure your gas is topped off. Bring maps.
It sounds like you're prepare as you're like going to the desert. It sounds like it would be like a good
prepare as if you were traveling during a hurricane or a state of, you know, some
right
sort
a natural of, disaster where they tell you
state of emergency. Mm-hmm. Yeah. The same sort of things apply, even though at the end you should be able to get to a spot where you can see a fantastic natural phenomena rather than trying to flee a horrible natural disaster.
Right, and at the end of this, this is a great reward. Janika, for what advice do you have for people who are maybe only just hearing about it? Is it too late for them to come to Carbondale and see the eclipse? What's your suggestion?
It's not too late. We still have a lot of campgrounds that are available. Our traditional lodging is completely filled. However, there are several campground sites that are still accepting reservations. So any families that are willing to camp, it's a great opportunity to experience Southern Illinois. Our weather is normally in the 90s, so you wouldn't have to worry about it getting too cold. I would just say pack in layers. Don't bring any personal valuables. Bring any allergy medicine that you may need. Our climate is much different than it is in Northern Illinois. Having so many natural trees and large fields, the grass and the pollen might get to some people. So we would say bring some allergy medication, even if you never had allergies before. Sunscreen and bug spray and just staying well hydrated. Personal portable chargers for your cell phone in case you're not able to be in a car and charge up your phone. Have a portable charger with you just for emergency reasons. And organize meeting points with your friends and families in case you happen to split up with one another.
One other thing people should do is make sure to check the weather forecast before they head out, right?
I would hate for anyone to travel 6 hours on end and find out that that destination
it's cloudy.
Is cloudy or rainy, or, you know, your view is going to be obstructed in some type of way. I recently read an article from a gentleman who said he was near water and the mist rose as the eclipse was coming by, and the mist obstructed their view.
from seeing a total solar eclipse. So that might be something that is of interest of some people.
Yeah, well, let's hope the weather cooperates.
Yeah,
that's a great
point.
Always
the thing.
Janika, I have to ask you, where are you going to be for the totality? What part of Carbondale are you going to be in?
I will be located on Eclipse Day at Saluki Stadium. I will be joining the 16,000 viewers that will be located in the stadium, along with NASA that will be broadcasting live for 4 hours from our destination.
And Diane, how about you?
I live in Western Massachusetts, so I will be, my family is going down to Charleston. And we've rented a cottage, and our whole idea is that we will get there ahead of time and we will be able to just walk out and look up.
So are you driving to Charleston, South Carolina?
We are driving to South Carolina.
Oh, my. Okay. Well, that's a long drive from Massachusetts. Well, I want to thank Diane Kelly. She's a freelance science writer. We'll tweet out the piece that she wrote for 848, as well as Carbondale Tourism's Eclipse Assistant Coordinator, Janika Lopez. Janika, Diane, thanks so much.
You're absolutely welcome. Thank you.
I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media, broadcasting today from the Medill Newsroom in downtown Chicago. Thanks for listening.